Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. I thought I would start off with some helpful hints. We are now in this county live on My Turn. What, you might ask, is My Turn? Well, this is the California State Public Health Department's register for your COVID vaccine site. And isn't that nice? Plus, they promise to call you back or email you or text you, as the case may be. I'm going to give out the website. It's pretty easy. myturn.ca.gov. And just to make sure it was working and also to understand what I had heard Tuesday on my meeting with Dr. Gail Newell, the county public health officer, it's going to be maybe actually a lot easier to get your vaccine. Fingers are crossed. My niece, who's down in Southern California, told me, oh, yeah, well, now it's available for, you know, and she's in the age group. And so everyone can get a vaccine. And I'm like, yeah, well, kind of, sort of. They're still going to roll it out in terms of availability and all of the other criteria that have previously being used. So if you're a healthcare worker, if you're over 65, you're still going to jump to the front of the line. And that's important because that's the high-risk group. However, we're no longer not giving vaccine to people who aren't in those groups. And as it becomes available, and I'll have more about that in a few minutes, things are looking really good for probably the beginning of May. And lots of us are going to get our shots in April. Here's what you do. You go to that website and you register. And you're going to register and check your eligibility. And once you've done that, and this is the key, folks, this is what I learned on Tuesday. Scroll down, because you're probably going to be told, we have no appointments for you at this time. That's fine. Scroll down, because what you will get is you will get appointments in your zip code or nearby in your county, that is to say. So when I did this today, I got information about getting my vaccine at Safeway and getting my vaccine at the Walgreens down in Watsonville. So it's available. And then you would click on those websites. So it's enroll and scroll, enroll and scroll. Scroll down. Even after you get the, oh, we have nothing available, you got to scroll down off the page. And there you will find these lovely little other websites that may be able to give you an appointment. So go do that. Do that now. Get yourself enrolled. Give them either your email or give them your cell phone. If you don't have a cell phone, you can go ahead. There's an 800 number that they give to you to have help getting yourself registered to get information back. So even if you have neither email nor cell phone, you can still be contacted. But there you're going to have to sit on hold and talk to a human to get yourself fully registered for notification. You want to do this, all right? If you are interested at all in getting a vaccine, you want to do this. And why do I say that? Well, because the pipeline is gearing up and it's really looking very promising. President Biden has a goal of having enough vaccine for all 260 million adults in America by June. So Pfizer and Moderna have to each deliver 200 million doses of their two-shot vaccines by that deadline. And the federal government has got and distributed 110 million doses so far of Pfizer and Moderna. Meanwhile, the Janssen vaccine, that's the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, has pledged to deliver 87 million doses of its one-shot vaccine by the end of May. So these numbers are starting to look pretty good. A record of 2 million vaccine shots are being given each day in the United States. But we still are losing 1,700 Americans a day, so we've got a backlog. Let's talk about how these vaccines are made and how we go about increasing production, getting past that production bottleneck. So let's first talk about what production looks like. The pipeline for Pfizer starts in St. Louis, where bacterial cells are embedded with the DNA blueprint for the coronavirus spike protein, and they're grown in massive steel vats. After about 4 days, scientists break open those cells and strain out the DNA, which is frozen and shipped, or sometimes carried by jet or helicopter, the company's, you know, personal jet. I guess the executives aren't getting to fly around the country anymore, off to Andover, Massachusetts. There, it's incubated with the genetic building blocks that are used to create messenger RNA. This is what we are injecting into the human body. Now, that frozen messenger RNA is transported to Kalamazoo, Michigan. And there, it's used to make the bulk vaccine and packaged essentially in those nanolipids, capped, inspected, labeled, and shipped. Meanwhile, over at Moderna, their messenger RNA is made in Massachusetts and Plymouth and Portsmouth, New Hampshire, then packaged in Bloomington. They've got the assembly line there running 24/7, and they have five shifts of 2,000 employees on their line. Now, the Janssen vaccine, made by Johnson & Johnson, uses a cold virus, one that can't really make you sick because it's missing some of its DNA, but the capsule of the virus is used like a syringe to deliver the DNA instructions for fighting the virus. It takes 2 months to ferment this vaccine, and that's supposed to take place at a Baltimore plant run by a partner firm called Emergent. However, Emergent has, as of March 19th, had not yet received FDA's approval. They have now got it, and so production is starting. But already they were making vaccine. The first 4 million doses were produced in the Netherlands. They're saying that they're on course to deliver 100 million doses by summer. It's hard to rush this process because of the incubations. So do we have enough raw materials? That was another bottleneck, obviously. And we need more lipids. Both Pfizer and Moderna use lipids. And yeah, you know, they weren't ready to prepare to supply all these lipids for billions of COVID shots. So Pfizer and Moderna are frantically sourcing material from the United States and Europe. And oh, by the way, both Trump and Biden administrations invoked that Defense Production Act to give Pfizer and Moderna priority for the lipids. And they also used this law to address the shortage of glass vials, which another thing, there's a lot of pieces to this, but the pieces are coming together. Also things like, you know, machinery, tubing, filters, all the pieces are coming together. Merck got a $269 million contract with the United States government to completely turn over two of its facilities to making the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. In other words, a rival company is going to ferment the vaccine in one area, and the other side will provide the fill-up services. So we are looking at a real kind of World War II effort to get things going and get them going fast. And things are looking up. Pfizer has already struck deals with 10 different partners. And let's see, Sanofi in France, whose vaccine just didn't make the grade, is going to help both Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer fill the vials because they have the vial filling. So this is really good news, and you want to get yourself registered, and it's not difficult, but you do need, like I said, to enroll and scroll and go through the process so that you can be notified. If you're not interested in getting the vaccine and you want to get sick, well, or you've been sick with COVID-19, a new study just came out looking at blood samples from 188 COVID patients. And these were people who were 8 months out from their vaccine. And their levels of antibodies were actually quite low in their blood samples. But their blood was very toxic to the virus because they had lots of trained T cells. Also, when they tested that blood against the new variants of the virus, it was extremely effective. So those T cells aren't just attacking the spike protein. When people who've had the vaccine, they're going to have a longer-term immunity. Does that mean that they won't test positive? No, it probably means that people 8 months out can't get sick. They might be able to harbor the virus in their nose because that's largely an antibody-driven resistance, but they probably won't have enough virus reproducing in their nose to be able to infect anyone. So let's all take a deep breath and ignore some of the doom and gloom stuff that's coming out through the press, because it truly is a doom and gloom situation. And this is, as I said, looking up. I'm going to take a moment and step onto my soapbox. And we're changing topics now. Enough of COVID. We're done with the COVID update. As you may know, I took training in the Bredesen protocol called RECODE, which is best described in Dale Bredesen's book for the general public, The End of Alzheimer's. This is a complicated analysis of Alzheimer's dementia in its several different forms and helps people understand which type they have and what their vulnerabilities are and what to do about them. And I've been working with people for several years now. I've been seeing recently how info on the internet is actually getting in the way of people making a successful change that might help them reverse mild cognitive deficit and maybe even delay worsening. Supplements are a big, big business, a $35 billion a year business, by the way. That's about 20% of what Americans spend totally on food in the United States as a country. And it's more than the annual profits of GM and Ford combined. It's a huge chunk of change. So naturally, there's a lot of money to be made. Where there's money to be made, there's advertising to be done. And there is a lot of advertising on the internet, testimonials, subscription programs, supplement plans, all dedicated to helping you counteract dementia. And I've been seeing more and more people who think that they can substitute pills for lifestyle. It just doesn't work that way, folks. All the resveratrol in the world won't fix a sedentary lifestyle or a poor set of sleeping habits. Vitamins and probiotics don't feed a healthy microbiome. Only a healthy diet does this. I talk about supplements a lot on this program, but I want to emphasize that's an added value, maybe avoiding the complications or the potential risks of pharmaceuticals by using large doses of supplements. Nothing makes up for the standard American diet. And this is coming from someone who believes in supplementation as a medical therapy. Nothing makes up for inadequate sleep. Nothing makes up for 24/7 stress and its erosive effect on your body. And nothing makes up for the accessible excesses of the modern world. Don't fool yourself. Your dementia will progress if you don't check the boxes of good sleep, good diet, and good exercise. And by exercise, I mean both physical exercise and mental challenges daily. And last but not least, managing stress and including relaxation and family time and love and creativity and bliss as part of your life. Oh yeah, and one last word. If you are over 70 and have never had a stroke or a heart attack and are suffering from cognitive dysfunction, ignore your cardiologist. He cares about your heart and not getting sued in that order. And he does not care about your brain. That is not his or her department. And there you go. That's what it is. I have a quote for you to close off this segment. I had to investigate because I was seeing it attributed to multiple different people. This is actually from Upton Sinclair, a socialist. Oh, quelle horreur, who ran for the governor of California in the 1930s. He said, "It is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it." And I'm going to say that in the case of the cardiologist, that's probably true. The incremental benefit of that statin in a 70-year-old male or female, but especially female, who has never had a heart attack and does not have cardiovascular disease or a stroke, yeah, the incremental benefit of that is not worth the brain cells that you're giving up by torpedoing your brain's ability to make energy. So I'm pretty vehement on that. I'm going to step off my soapbox now. Our next related story is, could apathy in middle age be a predictor for some forms of dementia? Well, while it's easily mistaken for laziness or depression, a loss of motivation and interest in life has long been associated with a type of dementia called frontal temporal dementia. And this is a condition that's typically diagnosed between 45 and 65. But researchers at Cambridge University tracked 304 healthy people who carried the gene for frontal temporal dementia, and 296 of their relatives who did not. None had dementia at the beginning. The researchers looked for signs of apathy and conducted memory tests and brain scans. People with the gene were more apathetic than family members, the ones who didn't have the gene. Their apathy grew as time went on, and it turned out it was a predictor for cognitive decline, and MRI scans showed brain shrinkage in the areas supporting, would you be surprised, motivation and initiative, just as brain scans can diagnose Alzheimer's by showing shrinkage in the hippocampus, the area that controls memory. So we know that these diseases begin manifesting themselves a long time before cognition is affected. And the fact is, it may be something that we really want to look at. We're going to talk a little bit later about insomnia and the implications of insomnia in this situation. I said I was going to have a show full of tips, and so I just want to give you a tip. Stanford University scientists have confirmed that millions of people working from home already knew this, by the way, but now it's been scientifically proven. Zoom fatigue is a real thing. It's a thing. In a peer-reviewed study that was recently published, researchers concluded that video meetings are exhausting and stressful, more exhausting and stressful for people than those conducted face-to-face. And they've identified four factors behind this fatigue. First of all, the need for constant eye-to-eye contact. I want you to think back, if you can remember that far, to the last time you were in a business meeting. Somebody's talking, some people are looking down and taking notes, some people are probably thinking about something else, but very few people are actually looking at the speaker for very, very long, and nobody's making eye contact across the table. Another factor they identified is seeing one's own face on the screen while talking. And having read this, I then looked it up and I discovered you can turn off your view of your face in Zoom so that all you're seeing are the other people. I highly recommend it. It's Google how to turn off my face in Zoom if you can't figure it out. And lo and behold, you've already eliminated one of the major factors for Zoom fatigue. Another one is having to sit still for long periods. And advertising again, I just heard a whole piece about how wonderful it is to jump up and down on a trampoline while you're Zooming. Okay, that's ridiculous. But if you are using a standing desk, stepping while you stand is probably a very good idea. And those of you that have varicose veins and are using a standing desk, you're probably going to want to use some compression socks to avoid getting into trouble. But stepping is pretty good, and you only appear to shift from side to side. Again, who cares but the people who are watching you might be entertained and therefore get a little less Zoom fatigued by watching your movement. And for me, the big one, because I have been taking care of people medically for, 32 years at this point as a licensed MD. And I can tell you that it's hard to do without the body language. It's hard to do without seeing what people are doing with their fingers and their hands and the eye movements and all of the subtle micro expressions that really don't come through on a postage stamp size screen. It's really, really hard, and I have to concentrate much more assiduously. Taking audio-only breaks was one of the recommendations, reducing that selfie window I already gave you. And, you know, just go to audio-only, turn off your screen, and, you know, jump up and down. Maybe even jump on a trampoline if you want to pay, you know, the outrageous prices that people are now getting charged for trampolines. But the point is, try to get away from just standing there or sitting there and staring. It is not good for your body, and it isn't good for your brain. We're hoping that we're going to see some changes in the amount of Zoom that we're required to do soon, hopefully in the near future. But that's still in the future, and you can take these steps in the present. Moving away from the present, we're going to go to some emails. And this first one that we're going to talk about comes from England. Amy in England writes, I've been listening to your show for many years and appreciate your approach to medicine and science-based health. I'm a 58-year-old woman, went through menopause with absolutely no issues about 4 years ago. I'm very healthy, physically active, of normal weight, eat a plant-based diet, and on no prescription medications. Go, Amy. Would it be beneficial for me to go on to hormone replacement therapy medications at this late stage in terms of long-term health benefits, even though I've not had any issues with menopause? If so, I live in England and bioidentical hormones are not readily available, so is it worth going down the pharmaceutical route for a healthy person such as myself? All right. Well, Amy, I'm going to start with the bioidentical hormones issue, and we're going to go with check and see if you can get estradiol. And estradiol is bioidentical. So 17-beta estradiol, if that's available in a patch form in England, that's what you would want to ask for. And look if you can find progesterone. And this is available. Micronized progesterone is available. It is a generic. The trade name for this in the United States is Prometrium. I don't know what it is, but that is also a bioidentical. What I don't recommend is the synthetic hormones, and those are not metabolized by the same way in the body, and they can get you into trouble. As far as would it be beneficial for you, it rather depends on your personal situation. A bone scan will tell you whether or not your bones are at risk. It sounds like you've probably never been on steroids. If you have an adverse family history, it might be worthwhile to get a bone scan. And the same thing goes for your cardiovascular. The data on cardiovascular is pretty good if you go on the hormones before 5 years out from menopause, particularly someone like yourself who's eating a good diet. It does delay the development of hardening of the arteries and cardiovascular disease pretty much across the board. And it takes about 4 years for there to be a benefit. And we know from the HERS study, which is published over a decade ago, that that benefit accrues even in women who are over 60. So you've still got a window of opportunity. And that was the average age, basically 10 years post-menopause. You still see a benefit in the long run, and you're probably going to have the long run of cardiovascular disease. The bioidenticals in a person on a plant-based diet probably have minimal increased risk for breast cancer. But if you have a family history of breast cancer, you have to look at that very carefully. Or if you have other risk factors, like perhaps a history of chest irradiation, that might be another reason to be a little wary of that. And I'm talking about irradiation for cancer, so I'm assuming this doesn't apply to you. you don't have diabetes, you probably don't have any inflammatory disease. And the last thing to talk about, which is relevant to the earlier discussion, is your family risk for Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease is more likely in women who don't take hormone replacement therapy. This may be due to the anti-inflammatory effect of estrogen or to some other factor. But in people who have a strong family history, I generally recommend, you know, diligence in terms of surveillance for breast cancer. Otherwise, I do encourage people to be on at least a basement level of hormone replacement therapy. Oh, here's a fun one. The microdosing of psychedelics. So you've probably heard from somebody in the Silicon Valley about taking small doses of LSD or magic mushrooms, microdosing. It's supposed to sharpen your mind and encourage creativity. Well, it may be another mirage. It may be that you just think you're more creative and coherent. I don't know. You have to do performance testing, right? And you need a placebo. Well, researchers in the United Kingdom at the Imperial College of London recruited 191 volunteers, all of whom were already microdosing. They prepared 4 weeks' worth of gel capsules. This is, I guess, the participants had to do the preparation. And they were either containing a low dose of the drug or a placebo. They had two batches, and then they chose one batch at random. And at the end of the trial, all the participants reported on an improvement in their well-being. And they all said, oh, yeah, it's working. Then they tested the capsules that that group had been using. And basically what they found was, yeah, not so much. There really was no difference in how people rated themselves. This was perhaps an example of the positive expectation effect. And that positive expectation effect is, well, let's call it the placebo effect. That's what it's usually called. And this is something that is, as far as I'm concerned, my spin on the placebo effect is it shows how powerful the mind is in controlling and influencing the body. Other people have a different interpretation. But for me, this is just another study showing that if you think that you can do better, maybe you can. Now we need to follow up on that study with performance testing of some kind that can give us an objective indicator of whether or not people are actually performing better. But everybody thought they were. So let's find out if the group on the microdosing actually were. So now we're going to go to another email. This is another person writing from far away. What's happening to my local audience? Why aren't you emailing me? This comes from Nina in Plant City, Florida. Hello, Nina. Nina has had a long and winding road. We're not going to repeat it all for you, but she believes that she and her husband and her daughter have been ping-ponging back and forth pinworms. She grew up in Sweden, but the doctor grew up in India, where pinworms are a larger issue. So her doctor gave her imbendazole, which is a very expensive agent. And to make a long story short, then her husband's butt started itching. And then they took a stool sample, and it was negative for parasites. So they did another drug therapy, and it still didn't work. Her butt was still itching. So then after about a year, they did a tape test, which is essentially the way I tell my parents is you sneak into the kid's room in the middle of the night, right at sunrise while they're asleep, and you take some scotch tape and you go plunk, plunk, plunk around the anus, because that's how you find pinworms. They like to come out when it's dark, but they have their maximum activity in the morning. So if you get in there early before the kid wakes up, you can find them. And of course, she had the tape test, was negative. So here we go. Nina decided to go online, and she found online information about pinworms and how they could be helped by a product called Bitter Melon. So I went looking to see if indeed Bitter Melon did anything, and I found one scientific article looking at the Bitter Gourd or Bitter Melon And it tested it as an anti-wormer, and it did find a fair number of studies where it did show efficacy as a surface agent. And this was for various types of worms, and including some rather nasty ones like Strongyloides and, you know, toxic worms. Ascardia is another one that they tested. Pinworms are really not a big deal. They're a minor inconvenience because they make your butt itch, but they are otherwise harmless to humans anyway. And there really is no scientific evidence that the use of the bitter melon juice will work for pinworms specifically. But it is a benign agent, and it does have actually some fairly good benefit for acting as an antibacterial, antifungal, antiviral medication. And it's got an established literature of safety. So I'm like, well, maybe I'm going to start using that for people who actually do have worms if I don't want to use a more toxic agent. And it does seem to have some scientific legs to it. But, Nina, I think you need to prove the diagnosis. As I said, just as people can think themselves to feel better, you can also have what I call the scabies effect. Every time I treat a patient with scabies, I walk out of that room itching, and I itch for days. You can think yourself well, like our microdosing people, but you can also think yourself sick. The witch doctor's curse, right? If you believe the witch doctor when he tells you that you're going to die, your odds of dying actually go up drastically. You can think yourself dead, but you can't do it on purpose. You can only do it when you're effectively hypnotized by the witch doctor. This is a person, your subconscious believes it, and damned if it doesn't happen. Wow. So you must verify your diagnosis, and so far you haven't, and I think you need to look at other causes. I'd like you to look up pruritus ani. That's P-U-R-I-T-I-S-A-N-I. Things like caffeine, there are a whole host of things, including food sensitivities and yeast infections in the colon, or yeast overgrowth, I should say, since it's not infecting you, it's simply taking advantage of a little free lunch. I think that's where you need to go here, Nina. I think you're barking up the wrong tree, and I think you've been doing it for a while. So I hope that's helpful, and I hope other people have enjoyed just that quick description. Now we're going to move on to the real long bit of this. And this is our science lesson about the circadian rhythm. I want to start with just defining that. Okay. There's a 25 hour period of spontaneous activity in our body. It affects our brain, our cognition, our physiology in fundamental ways, how much inflammation, how well we heal, how well we digest, and things you can measure like blood pressure, heart rate, hormone levels, your respiratory and exercise capacity, and your blood coagulation are all influenced by this chronobiological clock. For example, the mid to late afternoon is the best time to exercise for strength and flexibility. If you're prone to injury with exercise, you're going to get less injury if you exercise in the evenings. And there actually isn't any scientific evidence that exercising in the evenings interferes with sleep as long as you give yourself about an hour or an hour and a half to reset. And you know I love the microbiome. Well, the microbiome also is affected by circadian rhythm. So in the sort of theme for this program, which is helpful hints, let's give you some helpful hints about when to do what. So let's start at 6 in the morning. This is when most people, we're using 11 p.m. as our bedtime. So let's be clear. Let's start with 6 a.m. because that's an hour before you would be getting up. And an hour before you were getting up, if you stayed in bed for 8 hours at least, at 6 a.m., is when your body's systems start to awaken. So your cortisol level has already spiked. Your cortisol is driving all of these other things. Things start to wake up. And between 7 and 9 a.m., that's when your hormones are at their peak. So if I'm trying to test a man to see if he has low testosterone, I'm going to check an early morning specimen, really ask him to get in there between 7 and 9 a.m. so that we can compare apples to apples, because all of those normal levels are based on a morning specimen. Cortisol also, if you're going to measure it, you really need a specimen that comes in before 9 in the morning. Interestingly enough, about the time we're shaving or going to work, commuting, 8 to 9 a.m., that's when we have our highest pain threshold, which I found fascinating. Between 10 a.m. and noon, we're fully fit, fully wide awake, and the brain is working at its peak efficiency in this 24-hour cycle. And around noon, you should probably have already eaten. That's when your digestion is in top gear. And if you haven't eaten by noon, you probably should. So those of you who are doing a time-limited diet, you want to get something in your stomach by noon. And ironically, without even having seen this article, I already knew that. You hit a low between 1 and 2 in the afternoon. Maybe you should take a cat nap. Certainly, if you can, that would be a great time to take a coffee break and make it a chill break. If you can lean back and put your feet up, great. If you've been standing at your standing desk, it's probably good to get out the yoga mat, lie on the floor, and put your legs up for that 15 minutes and do maybe some restorative breathing. Around 3 and 4, you get a new kind of upswing in your brain, and this is the time when you have the best learning and long-term memory. And I will add, all of this data is supported by specific psychological or physiological research, and it is generalized, so your experience may vary, and it has to do with your sleep-wake cycle, but still, the sequence of events is going to be true across the board, more than likely. So you're going to do your best memorization and long-term memory in the late afternoon, and if you're going to do some manual work, you get a second physical peak. And by the way, that would also mean physical exercise. So, you know, probably your exercise, if you don't get it in the morning between about 8 a.m. and noon, you probably could try to get it in between 5 and 6 p.m. Surprise, surprise, between 6 and 9 p.m., we have our optimum sense of smell and taste, and that's when you should be eating dinner. You should stop eating by 9 p.m., assuming that you're going to bed at 11 p.m., and ironically, and this is absolutely something I experience and it's frustrating, your creativity is actually at a peak after your bedtime. Maybe that's because your critical senses have started to shut down in preparation for getting you ready for bed, or maybe it's something else entirely. But if you need to do something really creative, it might be good to stay up a little bit late and give it a shot. If you're blocked or something, give it a shot at 11, between 11 and 1, and see if you can break out of your creative blockage. So what is going on here? And now we're moving in. This is why you should care. And now we're going to, and what you should care about. Now we're going to talk about how does this happen and what on earth is going on? Well, first of all, I wanted to talk about how old this is, because this is genetic, and we'll talk about the genes and the mechanisms in just a moment, but I was fascinated to learn that we share the same genes with the fruit fly for our biological clock. It is so old and so embedded in life forms that we have the same DNA for this as insects. And so now we're going to talk about what's going on. Most of these studies that I'm going to talk of now were in mammals. And we have mammals where you go and damage the hypothalamic suprachiasmatic nucleus. When they're damaged, you get a complete disruption of the circadian rhythm. So that's how they localized it. There are special neurons in the suprachiasmatic nucleus called circadian pacemaker neurons, and they show a big variation in their firing. So neurons fire kind of beep, 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 beep. Even when you're not moving your muscles, the neurons to your muscles are firing a sort of low-grade beep, 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 beep. That's called tonic stimulation. Even a person who never moves will not lose all of their muscles. But if when you have a loss of motor neurons in the spinal cord, so for example, in polio or in ALS, the spinal cord signal doesn't get out to the muscle and the muscles wither. In the cases of people who have a spinal cord transection, even though their muscles shrink from disuse, they don't disappear entirely in the same way because that tonic stimulation is being generated well, south of the damage to the spinal cord. And so there's still intact cells that can reach out to the muscles in the periphery. So the firing rate is actually caused by a genetic oscillator. And I found this especially fascinating. This 500 million year old sleep-wake cycle really relies, first of all, on specialized cells in the retina. In these specialized cells, they are present even in someone who is completely blind. And so the light gets to these specialized retinal ganglion cells, and they notice light. The light goes to the suprachiasmatic nuclei, and does give that person a cycle. So only people who have either their eyeballs removed or they have complete lens opacity or they have some other damage to the optic nerve lose this sleep-wake cycle. The pigment that's in these specialized cells is called melanopsin, and it absorbs blue light. It is going to respond to morning light or daylight. And particularly after a period of darkness, it becomes very, very sensitive. When you're dark adapted, this, you know the difference. If you go out and you sit in a dark space for half an hour or even 15 minutes, and you can see things that you couldn't see when you went out there. That's called dark adaptation. And what's happened is that the pigments have all recovered their ability to respond to light. Humans are actually, the eyeball is so sensitive, you can respond to one photon of light, which is just astonishing. So artificial light in the evenings, how that messes with you, why blue light from computers is bad and screws up your sleep, we've covered that a lot. But I love the fact that what the light is actually doing at the neuronal level is it's turning on and off two genes. One gene gets turned on and it starts the circadian rhythm. The first thing it does is make another gene start. And this second gene is produced a little bit later. There's a delay. And that second gene turns off the first one. And there's your circadian rhythm. Two genes oscillating back and forth, essentially in an eternal yin-yang feedback loop driven, well, or I should say reset by light. And here's another thing. It turns out a ton of our DNA, not just these clock genes, but a ton of our DNA is controlled. So if you have an animal that you keep nocturnal, you phase shift it so that night is day and day is night, and you take the blood and the serum from that animal and you put it in tissue culture, the cells in tissue culture will divide and replicate their DNA in reference to the new clock reset. There are biological compounds released that control this. And it is hugely important for shift work. Light exposure at the wrong time of day messes up these clocks, and we know it can impair cognitive performance. We also know that circadian disruption leads to increased heart attacks and that responses to drugs are influenced by the time of day because the DNA is being turned on and turned off by this cycle. The first sign of Alzheimer's dementia may be insomnia, just like we were talking about with the frontal dementia before. The first sign of Alzheimer's disease is often insomnia, which is why drugs that are given to treat insomnia are associated with Alzheimer's. The cause and effect may be in the opposite directions. Many of our studies may be in the opposite direction. Maybe the circadian disruption triggers the accumulation of neurotoxic proteins, or maybe the accumulation of neurotoxic proteins in the suprachiasmatic nucleus is what triggers the sleep disruption, and that's just the first place those proteins end up. Well, we have to investigate this, but we do know that brain detox is drastically impaired by insomnia. That's not just it. It's not just dementia and insomnia. It's also mania. People who have a disrupted circadian rhythm, in fact, that may be the thing that drops people into mania. And we're still wondering, is it the insomnia that triggers the mania, or is the mania starting and that triggers the insomnia? And we honestly don't know. But what we do know is that there's an increased risk of breast cancer in shift workers and an increased risk of colon cancer. And light exposure at night increases the risk of melanoma. In mice, the damaging effect of sun on the skin is greatest in the morning, because it's in the morning when our DNA repair is actually at its lowest. There's also evidence that the production of one of the major enzymes that makes NAD, it's a cofactor in DNA repair. This is probably why in the mornings we don't do good DNA repair. People with rheumatoid arthritis have more joint symptoms, more stiffness in the morning. We used to think that was just the accumulation of cytokines, but studies in mice suggest that it's actually a clock function in the joint itself, not an accumulation of toxins at all, but just that the joints themselves are more inflamed in the morning due to the clock mechanism. By the way, another one, ischemia reperfusion injury. So that's basically if you get a bypass, a cardiopulmonary bypass in the early morning, your heart is going to have a poorer recovery than if you're lucky enough to have your cardiac emergency in the afternoon. So if you're going to get a bypass, schedule it in the afternoon. We know that there are more strokes and heart attacks in the morning. We know that there is a huge effect of this on diabetes. Glucose tolerance is lower at night in healthy persons. And in people with diabetes, they get a high morning glucose level. They get a big spike between the liver making too much glucose overnight and then the cortisol spiking up and causing delayed glucose uptake, because that's a stress hormone and it thinks the body needs to do fight or flight. But in fact, it doesn't. Blood pressure regulation is important. The list goes on and on and on. And what's the practical advice here? Well, number one, you're best advised to keep the same sleep-wake cycle throughout your week. That includes on the weekends. So sleeping late in the weekends is probably ill-advised. I think the most important thing is to have a consistent bedtime. If you have a consistent bedtime and you have to wake up earlier one day, that's going to work better and be less disruptive. You can entrain this body clock, particularly in the morning if you're having trouble waking up, by using that blue light in the morning and avoiding it at night by wearing blue blocker glasses or simply going away from the step away from the screen for a couple of hours before bedtime. These small changes can have a profound effect on all aspects of your health, reduce your risk of getting diabetes, cancer, heart disease, and dementia. And have I left out any of the things that we get? I mean, even car accidents, right? We get those, but car accidents are much more likely in people, like you would expect, with a dysregulated sleep cycle. So, good advice. Eat a healthy diet. That means lots of fruits and vegetables, adequate fiber, stay away from the artificial crap, and keep the sugar down. Exercise. Use all the muscles in your body. Move. Do a little resistance work. Do a little aerobic work. Mix it up. Play. How about playing? Playing is good. That's also relaxing. And life should not be drudgery. give yourself some relaxation, do some deep breathing, hug where you can, hug your dog anyway, because that level of joy and touch and contact, which we've been so starved of recently, it's coming back. Hold on, folks. The light, as they say, is at the end of the tunnel. We're getting close to the end of the show, and I just want to give you a couple fun facts. Sleep deprivation by 50%. So if you're normally sleeping 7 hours and you sleep 3.5, 2 days in a row, you're insulin resistant. After 2 days, your insulin resistance will go up 50%. You will go from being not diabetic to having an elevated blood sugar. And that sets off a cycle that you just do not want to play in that sandbox. Also, light reduces melatonin. So even a small amount of light at night screws you up. Get yourself a red flashlight if you have to get up in the middle of the night to pee. Stay away from that regular blue light. Stay away from the LEDs. Well, we've come to the end of the show, and I want to welcome you back next week in advance. I hope you'll be here. And until then, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.